This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Short story writer George Saunders, who Time magazine calls simply the best short story writer writing in English, joins us to talk about his novel Lincoln in the Bardo later in the program. But first, food does more than nourish and sustain us. It helps define us. We live in a region that seems already to be defined to the rest of the country in many ways, and part of what speaks to that definition is Southern food. So on this Thanksgiving, we're going to examine what we eat, why we eat it, and what it means, and at how food communicates something about us and shapes who we are. Dr. Ashley Stokes is the author of Consuming Identity, The Role of Food in Redefining the South. She's also Associate Professor of Communication Studies and the Director of the Center for the Study of the New South at UNC Charlotte. And also with us is freelance journalist, author, and creative director for the Symposium for Professional Food Writers, Andrea King Collier. She joins us by phone from Lansing, Michigan. Thanks both for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning. Ashley, when you say in your book that your book focuses on the role food plays in building identities and accounting for the messages food sends about who we are, how we see ourselves, how we see others, are you talking about us individually or collectively as Southerners?
Really both. I think that what we found out in our research as we traveled through 10 different Southern states in the South is we all have individual stories that we share about foods that maybe we eat within our families. But what we found out is some of those stories have things in common with other groups of people throughout the South. And so I think it maybe starts at a familial level, a family level, and it sort of spreads through there. So maybe Eastern North Carolinians have a story about barbecue, or maybe you have a story about shrimp and grits if you're from Charleston. But I think it speaks to both.
This idea that what we eat, what we cook to eat, how we eat, etc., communicates and shape something about us and shapes who we are. That might be a new idea to a lot of people. It's new to me. I never even thought about it. So talk about that for a second. How did you come up with that? How do you know that's true?
Yes. Well, I'm a humanities-based researcher, but my co-author and I went to graduate school together at the University of Georgia, and we studied the role of rhetoric, which is the idea of persuasion. And so we started looking at it in social movements. So she was looking at animal rights rhetoric, and I was looking at the slow food movement, which is an international movement that talks about, you know, moving away from industrial agriculture. And so anyway, we got curious about, well, how is it that we have views about what we eat, and how does it shape who we are, and how does it speak to sort of our families and backgrounds? And so what we argue is that, you know, food, what we choose to eat and serve sends messages. And so that's what we mean by rhetoric and persuasion.
Andrea, as you sit there in Lansing, Michigan, listening to all this, and you write about food, et cetera, does this ring true to you? Does food say things about us?
It does ring true to me because a couple of things. Whenever I travel, one of the things that I always do, whether it's the South or whether it's Europe, I always buy cookbooks. Because cookbooks tell you a lot about the history and the culture of the people where I'm visiting. The other thing is, I am a daughter of the South, a granddaughter of the South. And for me, when you talk about food, you also talk about our roots and our history and all of the recipes that we've brought back. I am still using recipes that I know were 100 years old, and I treasure them.
I don't know what kind of food is native or would be associated with Michigan, because Minnesota has a certain kind of food associated with it because of its the background of the people who moved there from Norway and Sweden. But when you talk about or when you think about Southern food, Andrea, what is it? What constitutes Southern food to you?
For me, it is the food that was served at my grandparents' table. So I'm talking about, like, okay, so here's a great example. All over the country, people fix macaroni and cheese, right?
Oh, yeah.
However, a good Southern macaroni and cheese is different, even if everybody's got their own little flavor. I love the fact that Southern food, whether it be fried chicken or greens and vegetables, and people tend to love a recipe the way their mother fixed it, if their mother was a good cook.
I think you
talk
about
potato salad.
Yeah. I think you talk about
like
that.
People can't eat other people's potato salad.
I was actually reading an article in the New York Times Sunday Magazine about Asian culture in America, and that's what they talk about when they get together to eat, how their mothers fixed certain dishes. So that must be something that crosses all boundaries. You wrote, Andre, in National Geographic, that Southern food is hot. By that, do you mean outside the South or just in the South?
No, all over. I think that you see, okay, I will say this, that people are now embracing their history, and people love good food. Southern food is good food.
Can you get Southern food in Michigan, for instance?
At my house. But I think that you can get great Southern food in people's homes, but you can also, there are restaurants in Detroit that really, as we say, throw down. You know, you have to find pockets. Like even when I go, whenever I travel, even in the South, if I'm going to New Orleans, which is my favorite place to go eat, I will say when I get in the cab, where should I go? Because I don't, you know, we all know the big name restaurant in New Orleans, but I want to know where the people like to go.
Your book, Ashley, explores the role that Southern food plays in building identity or a sense of self. How does it do that? How does food do that?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that food does is it tells our stories, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of people study food. You've got lots of historical scholars. You have chefs, for example. And what we're doing is looking at the message that we use that we share when we eat a particular type of food. So, for example, there's a big debate in our state about the differences between Western or Piedmont barbecue in North Carolina versus Eastern or Eastern North Carolina. Of barbecue.
Well, those people are just wrong.
What's your favorite?
I don't like barbecue. No, I was joking. But that's one of the things you do point to, that in Eastern barbecue, they don't want any tomatoes
right, yeah.
anywhere near that
yes.
barbecue, whereas in the Western side, they do. So what does that say about people on the East or the West?
So I think what we talk about is how...
On the East, they want vinegar, right?
Yes, and both use
And in
vinegar.
South Carolina, they want mustard.
Correct.
So what does that say?
Yeah, so what I would say is that, you know, it's not so much about, like, it is about the ingredient you use, but it's sort of the cultivation of the story you tell about why you use or why you don't use a particular identity. So if you're from Eastern North Carolina and that's what you eat, you're in a community of people who begin to share that story mm-hmm. together as a group, as a collective. And so you're sort of invited into that particular identity as an Eastern North Carolinian. So food becomes part of that.
So if we listen, I'd like to hear from both of you about this. If we listen to the stories that food allegedly tells us, I don't mean to be to be skeptical here, but if we listen to those stories, what would we be hearing?
I think that from my perspective, you learn that there's more than one Southern food story. So I think that there's this perception that Southern food is, you know, fried chicken or it's biscuits and gravy. And so I think when we were on the road, we heard lots of different stories about what it means to eat Southern and really what it means to be a Southerner. And what we found out is that these food stories point to our similar histories and traditions mm-hmm. that we have, even in an area of the country that's got a lot of division. You know, we have a lot of things that have plagued us in the South. And so food becomes a way, I think, for us to connect a little bit. We connect through those stories. So just for example, my husband and I went to the K&W on New Year's Day. We wanted to participate in the tradition of, you know, eating greens and black-eyed peas and, you know, things like that to bring good luck in the new year. And what we were just amazed, we were too lazy to cook it ourselves this past year, but you open the door to the K&W out on Independence, and the line basically almost went out the door. And it's amazing how many people tell that story and share in that tradition.
Right.
So you had a complete cross-section of Charlotte, for example.
Same question, Andrea. If we just listened to the food, what would it be telling us?
The food would be telling you that America and the South is diverse, and there are historical stories that need to be lifted up. One of the reasons why I started writing about food is I noticed, I mean, I've always been a foodie, but one of the things that I noticed is that the culture of the people who prepared the food in the South historically was being lost.
So why, if Southern food is hot, and it's hot everywhere across the country, and it's based on inexpensive, readily available ingredients, make-do food, why, in these relatively affluent times, why are these foods coming into their own?
You know, I think that there's a lot that's going on in the world right now. There's a lot of heavy, you know, topics that we're wrestling with here in Charlotte, in the state, and in the country. And I think when you read about Southern food, some of these ingredients, if you think about mac and cheese, as we were talking about earlier, there's a comfort level to that kind of food, that there's a familiarity maybe for a lot of people to it. It's something that's, you know, democratic, small d, that we can all participate in, and that maybe we can sort of, you know, maybe not always bond over, but again, that we can kind of talk about. So I think it's gotten popular for that reason.
But there are differences, as Andrea pointed out, there are differences in Southern mac and cheese versus other regions of the country. But I would wager there are differences in the South.
Sure.
So I want to hear from both of you. What constitutes mac and cheese? I'll start with you, Ashley.
Okay.
What's in mac and cheese?
So for my family, it was always done. It starts on the stovetop. You have to use your traditional elbow noodle. And so my mom would always make kind of like a sauce with milk and with flour on the stovetop, get that going. And then she would finish it in the oven primarily with cheddar cheese. And sometimes if she was really feeling fancy and if it's the holidays, we might get a few breadcrumbs on top. But that dish is, you know, always there. Mm-hmm. It's always basically made in that same, you can't tell you the proportions on the air, but that's the process in general.
Andrea.
My macaroni and cheese cost me a fortune to make. A lot. So somewhere between my grandmother's mac and cheese and mine, I probably took it up a notch. I'm using 3-4 different kinds of cheeses. Ashley and I got the elbow macaroni thing in process. I use a cream. You know, I could have you in the emergency room having a heart attack with mine, but we don't do it a lot. And then sometimes, if I'm really fancy, I'll add lobster to it, because I had that in a restaurant, and I was like, oh, my gosh. So I'm not cooking it on top of the stove. I'm doing it all in the oven with a little bit of egg to bind it and some heavy cream. Oh, also, let me not forget a couple of little dashes of Tabasco.
So both of you are doing completely different
right.
versions, but they're both Southern?
I mean, I think that they have an element of being attached to that, yeah.
So let me tell you how my mother used to do it.
Okay.
A box of Kraft. So what is that?
we had that getting off the bus, but the occasion mac and cheese is a little bit different. But yeah, we had both.
So you also mentioned, Ashley, that this food tells stories about our upbringing, how we view ourselves, but that we can enjoy Price's fried chicken.
Mm-hmm.
We can also go to Myers Park Country Club and enjoy their cooking. We could go to Bill Spoon's Barbecue one night, Barrington's the next, which is a high-end restaurant here in town, Andrea, because you're not here. You don't know that. Does that make us in any way special, or wouldn't the same be true of people anywhere in the world? They can go to a nice place one night, or you can go and buy food from a street vendor.
So I think when you were talking earlier about maybe Minnesota foodways, right, or Michigan foodways, so every region is going to have a distinct set of foodways. And I think what we're trying to do in the Southern food discussion is point out what those foodways are. Yes, certainly you're going to have traditions and foodways that you bond over in different regions of the country.
That's Ashley Stokes, author of Consuming Identity, The Role of Food in Redefining the South. Andrea King Collier also joined us. She's a journalist, author, and creative director of the Symposium for Professional Food Writers. You can hear our full conversation with both of them at WFAE.org. When we come back, we hear from best-selling author George Saunders. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley, a full-service law firm helping clients navigate the complexities of today's technological advances and constantly evolving data privacy laws. Details at Bradley.com. And Live Nation presenting Dead & Company at Spectrum Center in Charlotte, Tuesday, November 28th. Tickets available at LiveNation.com. Coming up tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, it's the biggest shopping day of the year. And it comes at a time when old line brick and mortar stores are losing sales to online retailers. What does this mean for stores and for malls and for you? We'll go shopping for answers on Black Friday. That's tomorrow at 9 on Charlotte Talks, here on 90.7 WFAE. More Charlotte Talks in just a moment.
When news moves swiftly, Morning Edition slows it down.
That my service in the Senate will conclude at the end of my term in early January.
We step back and make sense of the story.
The grand jury indictment accuses them of working on behalf of you.
And when you need a break, we take a breath.
Snoop Dogg stars in a new version of The Joker's Wild, calibrated to speak to him.
Be ready for your day. Wake up with Morning Edition every day.
Join us for Morning Edition weekday mornings from 5 until 9 here on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. George Saunders is well known for his short stories. Critics just can't say enough nice things about him. Time magazine has called him the best short story writer in English. Not one of, not arguably, but the best. He's been a National Book Award finalist. His latest book is on the New York Times bestseller list. And Stephen Colbert likes him so much, he seems to be on The Late Show all the time.
My next guest is a MacArthur Genius Fellow and quite possibly my favorite living author. Please welcome George Saunders. Nice to see you again.
Nice. You said quite possibly.
Quite possibly. Quite possibly.
Whatever.
I have to check with my other living authors right now. I might have them on at another time, and I have to be able to say the same introduction
it's
for
fine.
Them.
It's fine. It's
all right? I can't be painted into a corner here, George.
George Saunders' latest book and his first novel is Lincoln in the Bardo, and it recently won the Man Booker Prize, one of the most prestigious prizes in literature. We spoke with him back in April about his first novel, his writing process, and more, but we started with his TV appearances. Clearly, Stephen Colbert likes you. And it strikes me that the last time I remember authors being on late-night television with any frequency, and you're evidently on there a lot, has either been Jon Stewart or Jack Parr and Johnny Carson in the very, very early years. What's going on here? I mean, is this the resurgence of intelligence in late-night television?
Or something, yeah. No. Well, Stephen's been really good to writers. And lately, Seth Meyers is having a few of us on,
right.
too. So he's got to sort of pull our weight.
You know, I've had several authors on here when Oprah was still on television, and some of them had their books chosen by Oprah to be part of her book club. And they said that when that happened, their lives changed because book sales went through the roof.
Yeah.
They were no longer marginal, even if they were big sellers. They were big sellers now. Does late night television help you?
Colbert does, for sure. Yeah, there's a Colbert bounce. And
really?
And beyond that, I just loved the idea that, you know, a writer isn't considered some kind of freak, you know, that you can actually entertain the idea that literature is important for us and that it's actually not out of the mainstream as part of what we do as human beings. So I was
plus you at some point into some interview you said that growing up you didn't know that you could make a living writing.
No.
Now you're walking out on the Colbert Show.
Yeah.
People are seeing a writer walking out on the music's playing and the people are screaming and you're walking into the light and that must mean something to people who are out there who may harbor a fascination for writing.
I hope so. I hope, you know, because literature has always been something that people turn to when they're trying to be smarter, trying to be bigger hearted. So it's a different skill set there. I mean, I don't think Henry James would have been a great talk show guest, but I think, you know, to the extent that you can, it's good to get out there.
Well, what is that like? I mean, you have to, you know, walking into a late night television show, you're a writer. It's a very solitary profession. What is it like to suddenly have to walk out there and be on?
Yeah.
How do they prep you for that?
Usually there's not much. You know, there's usually a little bit of, you know, the host is interested in ABC, and then I kind of go off on my own and think about it and think, well, okay, if I had to talk in a five-minute burst about the three things that are most important to me, what would they be? And then you kind of wait for the question and try to respond in real time. He makes it really easy, though. He's, you know, they say he's a host, and he really is. He's so generous, really wants you to succeed, and he's also very watchful. He's watching you closely to see what, you know, what might work, and it's a lot of fun, actually.
I've talked to some writers of short stories before, and they always say that writing short stories is really difficult.
Yeah.
And that's what you chose to spend most of your career doing, writing short stories. Why are you...
Masochist.
Yeah,
early on it was just, I wrote one novel when we were first married and it was a family disaster. It took me a year and ended up being a complete flop. So it was partly just survival. You know, we had little kids and I was working. So you could maybe imagine writing a pretty good 5-page story in a month or two. So it was kind of just the size that fit my lifestyle.
But it's hard because you have to compact a lot of information and character development and plot development
into a very short amount of time. Yeah. But you said that when you sat down to write this book, Lincoln and the Bardo, you hoped it wouldn't turn out to be a novel.
Yeah, I mean, I had a pretty good shtick going about why I never wanted to write a novel. But, I mean, you know, this...
Wasn't that easier? You have more time, more space.
No, you don't, though. I mean, I think a writer has a basic DNA, you know, a basic pace they have to do, and mine is quick. So even though this is a novel, it's a pretty short novel, actually, and it works a lot like a story, you know. I think this whole storytelling ethic is a bit like a joke mentality. You know, you get to the end and there's either a payoff or not, and everybody knows whether there is or not. So that makes a lot of pressure to be not only succinct, but for me it means I have to do hundreds of drafts to get through the stupid stuff first so I can get down to the essence of what the story is.
I want to get back to this thing about people seeing writers on television in late night and maybe inspiring them to realize that that is a way you can make a living, and it is a way to exercise creative juices, and maybe that is a viable path for me in my life. You grew up in Amarillo, Texas, as I understand it. You were born in Amarillo. You grew up in Chicago. You barely, so this is, these are your words, you barely graduated from the Colorado School of Mines, not mimes, mines, M-I-N-E-S, with a degree in exploration geophysics.
You're speechless.
How did you go from that to being a short story?
Well, kind of gradually and then all at once. I wasn't that great of an engineer. I had a couple of high school teachers who literally got me into college, and I admired them so much, and he was a geologist, so I thought I'd follow in his footsteps. And then when I got there, I was sort of a C-plus student, maybe, you know, but always was sneaking off to read and write on the side. So at some point, I went to work in Asia in the oil fields, and while I was there, I had this kind of epiphany that I really wanted to write, you know, and so then I kind of had to start over from the bottom.
Yeah, you were I read The Oil Fields and the Jungles of Sumatra.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was kind of wonderful. I'd never been out of the country before. And at that point, I was kind of a right-winger. And I went over to Asia and had my eyes opened by a lot of stuff, by the generosity and the poverty and the way the world really works. So it was terrific. We'd work 4 weeks on and then have 2 weeks off with complete freedom to go. So I went to Russia, went to Thailand, went to...
So you were a right-winger. You're not now.
No. I'm left of Gandhi at this point.
So what happened to you? Where did you go wrong?
Well, honestly, what actually happened was I was sort of an Ayn Rand right winger, you know, that everyone had to be – the misfortune was a sign of some kind of misguided nature. So there was one evening, actually, I was out drinking in Singapore and feeling pretty good about myself, and walked by this big hotel excavation and saw some motion in there. And I looked in, and there was like 300 elderly Malaysian women moving rocks by hand. And somehow that, you know, I grew up working class, so that kind of threw a switch in my head, and I thought, oh yeah, so actually we can get bad luck in a lot of different ways. You know, it's not all about virtue being 100% rewarded. And so then with that switch thrown, I started kind of looking around a little bit more thoughtfully.
You know, you're not the only person who points to Ayn Rand and says that's where my political philosophy has come from. But she was a writer. She was not how would you describe her?
Well, I her book. I mean, I went to college because of
that. She wrote Atlas Shrugged.
Yeah, and I went to college because of that book. It was just the first intellectual shot fired across my bow in a long time when I was 18. I think actually now that when I read her now, I cringe a little bit because she does a lot of, in my view, a lot of falsifying of reality to propagate a political view.
So that's where it comes from.
Well, yeah, but in real fiction writing, you know, not that she's not a real fiction writer, but in fiction writing that I like better. There's a lot more writing in order to explore what reality is like. You don't come in with a preconceived idea. You try to come in with no ideas, and then the actual line-by-line progress teaches you about reality.
Right. You also have – you've done so many things in your life, odd jobs from a doorman to a roofer to a convenience store clerk. How many of the experiences that you personally had as a result of all these jobs and the people that you met or observed in those jobs – find their way in some cases, not verbatim, but in your writing?
Yeah, not so many in a linear way, but basically my feeling is, as a writer, you go out and you try to get roughed up by the world. You try to put yourself in situations high, low, comfortable, uncomfortable. And then when you get to the moment of invention, you're smarter, you know. So to have been genuinely poor, to have been worked physical jobs that were really crushing, also to have hung out with truly rich people, or to do all that stuff, right. When you go to make something up, you're going to be more truthful.
Because you lived, did you not, for a while in a what's the word I'm looking for? A homeless,
yeah.
With homeless people.
Yeah.
Did you do that to write an article? Or
I wrote a piece for GQ, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
On that. What was that like?
Oh, it was beautiful, terrifying. You know, it was in Fresno, and I actually inadvertently set my tent up in the middle of between two crack dens. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was going to be sort of this Steinbeckian playing guitar kind of thing, and it was, playing guitar on the campfire. But it was really frightening, and of course—
Frightening because they were frightening?
No, just because it was a very, rough— I mean, there were a lot of addicted people, a lot of mentally ill people, and you could just feel that, you know, the usual armor I bring as a college professor and a person of some means, they didn't care. And they didn't know. I was sort of incognito. So you could see the real rawness of that life. And, of course, the interesting thing is it brings up all kinds of things in you. Like, I'm a big advocate for kindness. Well, in that situation, I just had my guard up all the time. And all of those kind of bourgeois virtues that I always trumpeting about were really put to the test because I was so concerned about getting knifed, basically.
Wow. I understand. I don't know these are facts, but you became an avid writer because of being in the jungles of Sumatra. There's nothing to do in your off time, so you would just load up your knapsack with as many books as you could consume and read them, and then 2 or 3 weeks later, you'd go back and buy more books.
Yeah.
Because there was nothing else to do. Most writers are readers, are they not? Because
I think so. Yeah.
How does that help you with and influence you without you becoming a parrot?
Well, I think you do become a parrot. When I was young, I was a very good Hemingway parrot, for example. I think that's one of the stages you work through. First, you find a hero. You see the world through his or her eyes. You do that for a number of years. It's kind of a good skill-building thing. And then at some point, it starts to nauseate you because your actual knowledge of the world that you've acquired in a hard way can't get there in someone else's voice. So there's a beautiful critical moment that happens where you just are tired of parroting, and you have to go into that scary ground of trying to find your own voice.
Somehow you found your way to Syracuse, to the MFA program, and became in the creative writing department, and became a student. Graduated. Now you teach there. You're a professor there, and you say you have taught some of the most remarkable young American writers in the last 15 years. Are you teaching them, or just helping them chisel off the rough edges of natural talent? Because, I mean, I guess the question is, can writing be taught?
Yeah. At that level, you don't have to do that. We get 650 applications a year for 6 places. So when they come, they're already amazing. What you're trying to do is sort of psychologically mentor them to do the thing that only they can do.
And you said, I let everybody do what they want.
Yeah.
Can that really be true? I mean, you're a teacher.
You do. You let them do. You let them get to the end of the tether, and then you let them feel the snap a little bit sometimes. Mm-hmm. Also, I just do a lot of line editing, because often if a person has some issue, whether it's technical or aesthetic or psychological, you can't really talk about it from the outside in, but you can edit your way into it. So let's say somebody is parroting somebody else too much. You can edit that closely to show where they actually want to depart from their heroes. I had a kid who was imitating David Foster Wallace. Well, spent 2 hours on one page, and you could see that exactly where he was trying to not be David Foster Wallace within that text. But he couldn't see it until we line edited it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you're essentially the editor that you would have as a going when you go to get published.
Right. Right.
People don't like editors.
They learn to. You know, real writers learn to love editors. If you know, that's always the kind of the crossroads moment is, if you don't like being edited, you're probably in the wrong job. And especially if you don't like being self-edited, because my whole mantra is revision is actually 100% of the game.
Yeah, what is your process? Do you just sit down in front of a blank page, a blank computer screen, and start writing, or and just let it flow and then go back and change it?
Something like that. I mean, for me, when I think about writing, it's taking what I wrote yesterday on hard copy and just reading it and almost imagining there's a meter in your head, and this side says P for positive, this is N for negative. And the whole job is, as you're reading your own stuff, you're watching that arrow. Like, what would a first-time reader be thinking? Mm. If you're in the positive, that's great. Every so often it drops into the negative, and that's where the work begins. You know, you have to sort of say, well, first of all, don't deny that it did. Then say, why do we think that this, you know, page 6 suddenly became boring, you know? And then marking it up to fix it, putting it in, and just do that over and over again, many, many hundreds of iterations.
You made your your bona fides on short stories and short story writing. Is there an appetite for that among publishers and among readers for short stories, maybe more so today than ever before because we're so crunched for time?
Yeah, also the creative writing programs have made a market for because that's the easiest thing to teach. But it is, because in the format of a workshop, it's easier to work on a 15-page story. But still, I mean, having written my first novel now, the short story is a really cool esoteric form. It takes, you have to have read quite a number of them to really enjoy them all the way. So I think they'll always be a little bit less sellable than a novel, but it's an exquisite form that once you get the taste for it, it's really, I think it's probably the most truthful way of talking about the way life actually unfolds for us.
So when you sit down and write a short story or you put together a collection, in your mind, is there a theme that runs through those short stories, those collections, or is it just a scattershot?
There is a theme, but it's you discover it by putting it together. You know, my model is you're trying to know as little as possible in advance of everything. You know, the idea is your conceptual mind is a little dumber than your subconscious mind. So you start a story not knowing what it's going to be about. It tells you. Likewise, a collection. You've worked really hard for 5 years. Everything that's got above a certain bar, you put it together and the stories start cross-talking. And even up to the very last day, the book is teaching you what it's about.
You start writing a story and you don't know what the story is about.
Right.
So what are you writing?
You don't know. You're actually doing.
Yeah. Well, you have to start somewhere.
Well, you do. You start with something. I mean, I start with something that's interesting to me for reasons that I don't understand fully. And also something that feels like, yeah, I could do something with this. Just that slight notion. Then you start poking at it a little bit by revising, trying to make it better. And weirdly, it will often kick out a plot twist. Not because you wanted it to. It'll also kick out a politics, not because you want it to, but just almost like in biology when you had those seed crystals. You know, you start with one, organically it'll actually grow out to something bigger. So there's a great quote. Einstein said, no worthy problem is ever solved in the plane of its original conception. So the idea is you start a story not knowing what it is, or maybe you think you know a little bit, but the magic moment is when the story says, you don't know me well enough. I've got bigger plans for you than you know about. So that's a cool job.
So many writers have said and have told me on this program that sometimes their characters take on a life of their own. If they're sitting there, they're writing, and suddenly the character does something, and you go, oh. Mm. Do you understand that?
Yeah. It happens through technical means. You know, you're trying to make a sentence better, and suddenly the sentence adjusts itself, and there's a new person in front of you. So that's what I love about it, is the implication that there's a part of your mind, part of our minds, that we don't use on an everyday basis because it takes a lot of gestation time. But if you've been working on a story for a year, there's all kinds of things going on off stage that you don't even know about. And what I love about it is the person that I end up being on the page after all that revision is smarter than I am, mm-hmm. nicer than I am, funnier than I am, more comfortable with ambiguity, you know.
That's George Saunders, best-selling author of Lincoln in the Bardo. It recently won the Man Booker Prize, considered one of the most prestigious awards for literature. We spoke with him earlier this year, and when we come back from the break, we'll talk about where the idea for Lincoln in the Bardo came from. He carried the idea around for years and wasn't even sure it would be a novel at all. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins.
More Charlotte Talks in just a moment on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Discovery Place Science, featuring inventions of engineering genius Leonardo da Vinci. Attendees will experience inventions from flying machines to the world's first bicycle, Da Vinci's Machines, at Discovery Place Science. Coming up in 20 minutes on Point, prima ballerina Misty Copeland will be on to talk about the challenging beauty norms and loving yourself as you are. Plus, vanilla, chili, garlic, soy, the 8 flavors that define American cuisine and culture. Stay tuned for On Point coming up next at 10 in about 20 minutes here on 90.7 WFAE. More Charlotte Talks coming up next.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Robert Mugabe has ruled Zimbabwe since 1980, and now his reign may have come to an end.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
The large maximum security prisons in North Carolina, you could have a 30% officer vacancy rate.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're listening back to our conversation with George Saunders, author of Lincoln in the Bardo, his first novel, which recently won the prestigious Man Booker Prize. He's also the author of several collections of short stories, including 10th of December, Civil War Land in Bad Decline, In Persuasion Nation, and others. You may have also read him in GQ or The New Yorker. We spoke with him earlier this year, and before the break, we were talking about where the idea for Lincoln in the Bardo came from. So, you were driving, as I'm told, with your sister-in-law?
My wife and her cousin, actually.
Okay. Yeah. In a car past a cemetery in Georgetown in Washington, and she just happened to say, oh, over there, Willie Lincoln was...
Yeah, she pointed up on the hillside, and there was a little sad little crypt there, and she said that Willie Lincoln was buried there for 3 years, and... This is the part that got me. Lincoln apparently was so heartbroken that he went into the crypt on several occasions to hold the body or to view the body when he was president. So that was 20-something years ago.
And we know that's true?
We know it was reported in the papers that he had done that. Okay. So it's reported in different ways.
So yeah. When she said that to you, did you go, oh, I could do a book?
I did, and then I immediately said, no, I can't. Because I had, at that time, I think I had one book out, and the first books are... kind of first-person, funny, kind of satirical, almost sci-fi kind of things. And I just couldn't see any link-up between the way I was writing then and that story. So I kind of thought, okay, that's for somebody else. Too bad, yeah. You know. And I just put it off consistently for the next 20 years.
But when did you decide I'm going to do it?
About 2012. The 10th of December was done, and I was in that kind of weird period where the book's finished and you're just waiting for it to come out. And I thought, well, maybe I could just, you know, give myself a 3-month contract to try this stretch, you know. And at that point in my life, I was, you know, 50-something, and it felt important, you know. You could either sort of say, no, it's too hard for me, I won't try it, and then enact a kind of artistic death spiral, or you could just take the shot.
And you didn't know it was a novel when you started, and you were hoping that it wouldn't.
Yeah.
So that tells me that you were thinking that it would be somehow, for some reason.
Yeah.
Why?
I could feel, there was a lot there. You know, my plan was to do sort of one night in the graveyard. And even from the first few pages, it just didn't feel like it had story DNA. It seemed like it wanted to push out beyond that. I finished about a third of it and gave it to my wife after about 2 years. And she was like, yeah, this is good.
2 years?
Yeah, it's slow. But, so I was rooting for it not to be a novel because I didn't want it to be sort of, you know, chubby.
So many people may not know what Bardo is, because I didn't know what it meant. And I heard a conversation you had, I think, with Tom Ashbrook, and it was a peripheral in the back of my – I was doing other things. And I didn't hear the explanation. And even when it was over, I thought, well, okay, so what's the Bardo?
Bardo is – it's a Tibetan word that means transitional state. So it really – the way it's used here is
like purgatory.
It's like purgatory, except it's a little less harsh. You know, I mean, I was raised Catholic, and our purgatory was, you know, go sit on a hard bench until the end of days, you know.
But you know it's over. You know it's coming to an end.
That's right.
In Catholic tradition.
Right. And actually, in the strictly defined Bardo, I think that's 49 days.
Okay.
But it's a transition between the moment you die, it starts, and it ends with whatever comes next.
So is the title... does it have a double meaning? I know that Willie Lincoln is the deceased person in this. Mm-hmm. So he's in the Bardo. He's waiting to go on to his next position in the afterlife.
Right.
But is Lincoln also in the Bardo?
Yeah.
Because he is incredible mourning.
Yeah. This is the kid that he loved the most, the kid who was most like him, and the illness and the death came very quickly when he had his mind on other things. So I think my sense was he's the second Lincoln in the Bardo, and it's transition between fatherhood and not in this case, but also between, you know, he's got to go back to this incredible war that he's botching, and he's got to try to pull it out, and he's basically got, you know, a few days to make that transition.
Now, I got to tell you, I have not read the book because I don't have the book, and I didn't know you were coming here until about 20 minutes ago.
No, relationship is perfect.
In the scheme of things. But one of the things, I joke about this because I have to read a lot, and when the producers hand me a book, the first thing I do is open it and look at the size of the type and how widely spaced the lines are. And if it's big type and widely spaced, I'm happy,
right?
Because I can make a quick read of it, and Stephen Colbert jokingly opened the book on camera and pointed it toward the camera, and there's a lot of white space.
My kind
of book.
Yeah, yeah.
But it turns out that the reason for that is the construction of the book itself. You use is it almost exclusively epigraphs?
It's all monologue. Yes,
okay.
It's 200 or 300 separate monologue pieces.
I don't want you to give too much away. You can do what you want here. But as I understand it, Lincoln is in the crypt with Willie, holding the body, and around him, he's unaware of this, are all these ghosts who are also in the bardo, waiting to leave.
Yeah, you know, I had the problem of so Lincoln comes into the graveyard at night. Who narrates it?
Right.
So it could be Lincoln, in which case you get like 4 score and 7 minutes ago. That's no good. Or it could be, they think, maybe it's a gravedigger who's staying late. That doesn't really make sense. So I hit on this idea of having the story told by all these spirits who are kind of unhappily trapped in this bardo. And so it turned out to be this almost like a screenplay. It looks like a play text sort of like that. Yeah.
And they're commenting on all kinds of things in their past lives, their alive lives, and in their lives waiting to go on to the next thing. And one of the things that struck me that I did read was that one of the ghosts says, "No one has ever held us before," because he's in there holding his dead son.
Yeah.
You abandon the body and you move on with life.
Yeah, and when I was researching ghosts, one of the things that was so touching was some of the parapsychologists say that ghosts are lonely. They like it when you have a picture of the person they were on the desk. They don't like it when you use, for example, their gravestone as a foundation stone. So this kind of beautiful image of people who aren't able to move on for whatever reason still being heavily invested in being alive. And so in the book, the dead are sort of like they're all in denial that they're dead. They know something's changed, and they know they're kind of missing the party a little bit, and they really long to get back. So this moment when a living, breathing person actually honors one of them with his attention is huge for them. It kind of changes everything.
Wow.
Yeah.
Lincoln is an historical figure, and I would think that that provides problems and challenges for a writer, because you're mixing in some fact, as we know it, with the fiction that you have created. Does it worry you that people will read this book who are not up on everything Lincoln or Civil War or 1862 and think, wow, that's true?
Well, I assume they would do that. So I try to really stay within the bounds of what actually happened or what could have happened or should have happened. And so you're always doing this kind of thing where you're bound by the historical facts, but where else are you going to get Lincoln's thoughts but from yourself? So you do that kind of melding of my experiences as a father and even as a teacher and as a person, and you're kind of melting that down and putting it into a cast that is Lincoln. But I had, when I was writing it, I had a picture of Willie and a picture of Lincoln over my desk just to remind myself that those are real people and this was a real loss. And so I think kind of making sure that you're respectful in that way is kind of a good protection.
The 1860s, people in that time period, as I understand it, were preoccupied with death and the afterlife and searching for them. Mary Todd Lincoln used to hold seances in the White House, I guess, to talk to Willie and later on to Tad, who also died. And we know that she was clinically depressed for much of her time in the White House. We know that Lincoln carried the terrible burden of prosecuting a civil war which had brother against brother. The specter of death was everywhere. Does that play into this?
It does. I think I read somewhere that if you upscaled the populations, like 20 million of contemporary people would have died to enact the same proportion of death. So everybody had somebody that they lost, and you could see that the culture became really interested in it. To me, at some point the book switched, and it was started out being about the dead, and then, as you hope will happen in a work of fiction, it became about life. How, you know, yeah. So the ghosts are all kind of in denial about their true state. You know, as I think we are, and in the end, I think they find that. The whole job is to rouse themselves, or as Lincoln said, disenthrall themselves and try to take stock of what's actually happening. And in the book, it not by my design, but what happens is becoming aware of the situation actually makes them more loving towards one another and towards Willie, which is kind of a surprise dividend. I didn't see that coming in the book at all. But then, of course, you think, well, yeah, that's like life.
You know, today, when we look back on some of the things I've read about Lincoln in the time period, and particularly Mary Todd Lincoln, who was really preoccupied with this, a lot of people then had this macabre fascination with death. And you would think that going into the tomb and holding the body of your dead son, cold, stiff, not human anymore, is macabre. But you have called it a charged and gorgeous thing to have done.
Well, you know, partly if you think about the way we think about death, you've got this person that you've loved your whole life, been intimate with, cared about, protected, that person dies, and our mentality is get that thing out of here. That's kind of macabre when you think about it. You know, the idea that life is like an on-off switch. Most traditions say not so, that actually death is a sort of a gradual process, and when the person you love dies, it would be kind of weird if that body wasn't still a little dear to you. You know, it's been dear to you all along. So I think in some ways they had a more high-functioning view of death. You know, Lincoln presumably went in there because that thing reminded him so acutely of that thing that he had loved.
Funeral parlors are called funeral parlors because the body used to be in the parlor at your home. They weren't as afraid of death or
skeeved by it as we are. And you did the preparation. Yeah.
About yourself as a writer, you have said that you have, and I'm going to quote here, a modest little talent garden. So that means I have to be very smart about how I work it to try to get the most out of it and to sort of trick it. I can only get certain material to come alive, so that requires me being very crafty. And you told Mother Jones, when you're writing, you try to evade suckiness. And by
it's a technical term.
It's a great word. And by maximally evading suckiness, you might come up with something original. You don't give yourself much credit, do you?
No, I'm a lapsed Catholic, so I've got a very active inner nun. No, I think that's good practice, you know, to be a little skeptical of your abilities is kind of a good practice. It means you set the bar high and you go back to things again and again to try to. I mean, for me, it's mostly a process of trying to imagine the reader as being a really wonderful, intelligent, worldly person that I'm trying to please. That's hard, and it should be. That relationship should be intimate and should be almost sacred, that every time I write something, I should be thinking of you and going, huh, I wonder if I'm being boring. I wonder if I'm phoning this in. I wonder if I'm underestimating my reader in any essential way.
So what kind of creative material is it that you know you can deal with, or that you that's the stuff I should be writing?
I know it when I see it. That's the hardest part. I wish I could give you a one-line answer, but basically there's a lot of moving targets. You're changing as a person. The world is changing. So really the strangest skill set is just to say, when an idea comes to me, even if it's just a few lines of dialogue, does the heart leap at it or not? Mm. If it does, and partly that the feeling is, I don't know what that is. I don't know why that interests me. That's the best thing. When my mind starts saying, oh, that's about patriarchy, then I know I'm in trouble. You know, when you think you know why something's important, it's like love, you know. When you see somebody across a crowded room, the heart leaps. That's good enough. That's a good reason to start.
This book is about death and life, Lincoln and the Bardo. Do you write a lot about death?
I think I do, yeah. I've heard that I do.
Because one of the things that you're addressing in Lincoln is death and the fact that no matter how vital we all are, how permanent we think of ourselves as being, death is pursuing us and it's going to catch up at some point in the future. Does it help for us, do you think, to come to terms with that?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I think that a truly joyful life lies on the other side of that realization. You know, you can make a happy life in a spirit of death denial. And I've done that so far, you know. But every so often you get a look over the fence. And I think, you know, the people I know who are really wise are people who know very well that they're temporary. And somehow, in spite of that, have found a way to lead expansive, generous
lives. So is the message here that letting go can be freeing?
And I would be I'm not a big message person. I mean, I think for me, the message of the book is that when for an hour afterwards, your head should be spinning.
You talked about being right-wing and Ayn Rand fan, et cetera, early on in your life. Now you're on the other side of the political spectrum. But you wrote an article, I think it was for GQ, about Donald Trump. And you went to a lot of Donald Trump rallies, and you talked to people who were supporting him. And you found out that they had one thing in common, a lot of them, kindness. Mm. I mean, when you got them away from politics, they were nice people.
Yeah.
What did you see in those people that reminded yourself of you when you were right wing?
Oh, basically, I think
not that they're all right wing. Some of them are not.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, what I found a lot of things terrifying during that reporting. But one of the things I found encouraging was that we have very good public manners in America, mostly. We have what we understand. We have shared values of gentleness, sense of humor. Not being too full of yourself.
Volunteerism.
Yeah, yeah. So that was hopeful to me. And the people that I met were very willing to talk. They knew I was a liberal. They were, I'm sure, somewhat afraid I'd throw them under the bus. But I found it reassuring that there is actually a centralist view when you actually go out on the street.
Yeah.
I think that we could talk for hours about why that doesn't pertain in the political sphere. But
we only have a second left, but we're in these very contentious political times. Mm. And literally, we have 15, 20 seconds. How does it compare, do you think, to what Lincoln was going through in the Civil War?
Similar, but not as bad. I think, you know, at that time, the contention meant 10 or 20,000 deaths a day. So thankfully, we're not there yet. But the confusion and the polarity and everything was very similar.
That's George Saunders, best-selling author of Lincoln in the Bardo. It recently won the Man Booker Prize, considered one of the most prestigious awards for literature. We spoke with him earlier this year. From everyone at Charlotte Talks, happy Thanksgiving. I'm Mike Collins.